This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckaberry. Thanks so much for listening. President Obama announced on Tuesday a decision that perfectly underscores, I think, the complexity and hard-to-evaluate Obama years in relation to the U.S. uniformed services. Obama will commute nearly all of Army intelligence analyst Chelsea Manning's sentence for treason, as well as 208 others. The president also pardoned 64 people, including retired General James Cartwright. The Manning decision, though, sends a message of sympathy for what Manning had been through without technically reversing the sentence. More on that story, plus one person who is still holding out hope for a pardon in just a minute. But the announcement reflects the deep complexity of President Obama's relationship with the military while in office. His pullback in troop deployments and drawdowns on the battlefield was matched by vast increases in electronic surveillance, use of drones, and special ops forces, often operating directly out of the White House. While trying to scale back the military aggression of his predecessor, the president ambitiously targeted whistleblowers like Manning in the name of national security.
I think that when President Obama came into office in 2008, many of his supporters thought that he would roll back the Bush administration's open-ended war on terror. But I think that what ended up happening in a lot of ways, despite early rhetoric to the contrary, is that both the legal doctrines and many of the activities of the Bush administration got extended rather than rolled back. And now we are very much in the era of perpetual conflict.
Rosa Brooks is a former Defense Department official and currently a law professor at Georgetown University. She's also the author of How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything. Obama ended combat, but in a sense, further enshrined a permanent state of war.
I think he fell prey to two different things. One was just the power of bureaucracy that under the Bush administration, the executive branch, the national security bureaucracy, had essentially been retooled to focus on a kind of perpetually expanding conflict against always morphing terrorist groups. And that bureaucracy was pretty powerful. It's hard to roll it back when everybody's habits and paychecks depend on this particular understanding of the world. The other thing that happened, I think, was that he fell victim to a national security version of the Willie Horton effect. Remember Willie Horton and Michael Dukakis. You know, nobody wants to be the guy who fails to take action and then something really awful happens. He was able to end the large-scale U.S. combat involvement in Afghanistan and Iraq, and that was what his constituency had really cared about. But when push came to shove, it's always going to be easier for any president to say yes rather than no when the question is, we have the opportunity to kill this really, really, really bad guy who might do something really, really, really bad in the future. Do you want us to go for it? Nobody wants to be the president who says, nah, I don't think he's a big deal. And then, you know, 20 people are killed with a suicide bomb and it's your fault.
One of the head scratchers of the Obama administration and the legacy here on these military matters is this commitment to being incremental. It seems as though Barack Obama, for whatever reason, decided that he was going to be plausibly presidential in every phase of policy, Afghanistan, Iraq, the Middle East, the pivot to China, but not really make any radical changes. I'm just wondering, if you were to reimagine the military in terms of exactly what we need, how much smaller would it be? What kind of savings do you think we could get?
Yeah, I don't think it's a matter of size. I think it's a matter of which capabilities we're focusing on. I think that we get kind of hung up on these kind of arbitrary questions about, well, should the end strength of the Army be 500,000 people or 400,000 or 600,000? The bigger question is I think the fact that in some ways we continue to have a 19th century military. It's not even a 20th century military, it's 19th century military, in that we still act as though the primary recruiting target for our military, for instance, should be 18 to 20-year-old young boys. And that dates from an era in which you won wars by throwing more bodies at the enemy. It's not particularly appropriately matched for an era in which the conflicts are things like cyber conflicts, in which we're worried about things like economic interdependency and economic attacks and so forth. And if we were really reimagining our military, I think we would start from, okay, here's the range of threats that increasingly preoccupy our senior military leaders. who are the people, what are the things that we need, how would we need to retool everything from recruiting to military training and education to the acquisition system to take seriously those threats, not to continue to act on this fantasy that the big threat that's coming is going to be one where we can just throw a lot of bodies at it.
Drones, technology, cyber warfare. Are we even remotely prepared for what is coming? And did Obama, you know, move the needle in terms of that preparation?
I think he moved the needle both in good ways and in bad ways. You know, I think that we're certainly more prepared than we were 10 years ago to deal with other states using those kinds of technologies against us. I think that the military, internal to the military, not so much coming from the political branches, but just the internal discussions within the military, have very much been focused on what many in the military term gray zone conflicts, things that don't look like traditional wars with tanks and planes and lots of infantrymen, but that don't exactly look like peace either, that sort of contested area where the issues may be cyber, it may be fake news and influence operations, it may be other kinds of operations that, again, it involve assassinations, involve attempts to coerce and sow fear, but not at the level we traditionally think of as war. And the military is absolutely trying to think about those things. I think that the difficulty is that the structure and nature of the military and the structure and nature of the congressional budget process and authorization process makes it very hard to make radical changes. Everybody moves on from whatever position they're in after a couple of years, and there's no money and no glory for congressional leaders in thinking about retooling military personnel system as opposed to thinking about spending billions of dollars on a munitions plant in their district.
Does the appointment of Rudy Giuliani to be Donald Trump's cybersecurity chief reassure you that there's
going to be? No, it does not. It really does not. I mean, Rudy Giuliani is not a cyber expert by any stretch of the imagination. But I think the thing that really worries me moving forward in a Trump administration, I said a second ago that Obama had retooled things both in some good ways and some bad ways. The bad thing that I think has happened is that the Bush administration sort of pioneered a bunch of legal arguments that paved the way for really unconstrained executive branch use of coercion and lethal force. Drone strikes are the obvious example, though they're not the only one, that we essentially, the Bush administration created legal justifications for saying, hey, gee whiz, the terrorist threat's always changing. It goes from place to place. And the evidence about it comes from the intelligence community, so it's secret stuff, which means that we need the authority to detain and maybe to kill people anywhere based on evidence that will be secret, and it will be, the decisions will be made in a secret process by people we won't identify, and we're not even going to acknowledge after we detain people or kill them that we did it. And the Obama administration ended up, to a significant extent, embracing and extending those doctrines. Everybody during the Bush administration, including Obama himself, had said, oh, this is terrible, we need to roll it back. But I think what happened is he got into office, found that these were, in fact, kind of convenient to have this ability to act without a lot of scrutiny and without a lot of legal constraint. And to the extent that people raised rule of law concerns about it, he sort of said, you know, I'm a good guy. We're good guys. We're going to use these powers responsibly. And I think by and large they did. And they didn't take seriously the possibility that somebody might come along, the next guy in the White House, the next set of guys, and they wouldn't take those responsibilities as seriously. So that's what really frightens me, is that we're now in a situation where the executive branch has two in a row, George W. Bush and Barack Obama, asserted these very broad, very unconstrained powers with virtually no judicial review, and they're all in the covert realm. And now they're handing those open-ended powers to Donald Trump and Rudy Giuliani.
What about within the military culture? Is the ending of Don't Ask, Don't Tell an outlier, or has there been a broad rethinking of military culture in terms of the relation of men and women in service, as well as Don't Ask, Don't Tell?
Yeah, I think that's likely to be enduring. I think that after 15 years of conflicts in which women have, whether in a planned way or not, you know, they've been at the pointy end of the spear and they've been the ones just as likely to get blown up by the IEDs as the men. I think we have so much experience of men and women working side by side with just no issues. as well as, you know, just a huge cultural sea change in terms of attitudes towards gays and lesbians. One of the things, I was at the Pentagon during the period in which ending Don't Ask, Don't Tell was being debated, and one of the things that was just most striking to me, there would be things that would be on the news, and you'd walk around the corridors of the Pentagon, everybody would be talking about it, and everybody would be arguing about it. And Don't Ask, Don't Tell wasn't one of those things. It was just a huge non-issue, I think, for most men and women in uniform. Just their reaction was just, yeah, what's the big deal? Who cares? You know, so I doubt that that is likely to change, because I do think that that's a reflection of just a broader cultural shift that most Americans don't see the issue, and the same is true for most military personnel.
The profile of special operations forces has certainly increased since 9/11. If you look at the Obama legacy, what impact has that had on each of the branches of the service?
You know, I think that we've seen a shift in the last few years away from the kind of traditional power bases in the Army and the Marine Corps, and towards both special operations, but also a shift towards the more high-tech capabilities of the Air Force and the Navy. And that sort of very much tracks the Obama administration's determination, which probably will be echoed by Donald Trump's views and policies against large-scale land conflicts, towards more, well, can't we just solve every problem through a combination of surveillance, drone strikes, and the occasional special operations raid? If we really need to have people go somewhere, it will be a small group, in and out, end of story. The interesting question, obviously, are we likely incoming Secretary of Defense, retired Marine Corps General James Mattis, obviously himself as a Marine who has a very deep appreciation of the role of the land forces and the role of the infantry, whether that will shift in any way. But certainly the campaign rhetoric of Donald Trump tended to be leaning much more towards, we're going to use drone strikes, we're going to use air power, we're going to use surveillance if we have to, but I'm not going to get you into any of those big, nasty wars that the American people hate.
Rosa Brooks, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
Rosa Brooks is a law professor at Georgetown University and author of How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.